Is there a breath of fresh air in the world of superpower politics, or simply a more clever and more astute Cold War leader? Gorbachev will be in Washington on December 7th in order to sign the INF Treaty, which calls for the destruction of medium-range nuclear weapons. Is this the act of a man who is devoted to peace, or is the act of one who is, or is it simply a strategy by a clever diplomat who recognizes that his country needs a few years to concentrate on economic development before she can assume again her move to dominate the world? In just 2.5 years, Mikhail Gorbachev has captured the imagination of the world. When he was elected General Secretary of the Communist Party, few besides criminologists had ever heard of him. Now they have. They know him to be an articulate, pleasant, diplomatic person who is quite aware of the wishes and hopes of the world. They know him to be the first Secretary General of the Communist Party who dresses, speaks, and thinks like a Westerner, and the first Secretary General since Lenin to have a university degree. He's also the first General Secretary whose political life does not go back to the period of Stalin. Gorbachev was only 54 when he ascended to his office in 1985. Gorbachev is a son and the grandson of peasants. He was raised in the little village of Pribilnoia, which is in the North Caucasus district of Stavropol. He was too young for active service in the Second World War. He spent the years in school. During the long summer months, he worked as an auto mechanic and as a helper in the fields. His youth and schooling point up certain things about Gorbachev: his native ability, his willingness to do hard work uncomplainingly, and his single-minded purposefulness. It was a most unusual feat for a raw-boned peasant lad from the North Caucasus to win a scholarship to Moscow State University, which in those days had a student body made up almost entirely of the sons and daughters of the elite of the Communist Party. He studied law at the university, a skill which proved useful in his later career. Moscow's university's law faculty was practically the only educational institution in the country which gave students formal training in the art of oratory, how to give an impressive speech, how to present a case, and how to ask relevant questions, and how to conduct investigations. As a result, Gorbachev is probably one of the best speakers who has ever been in the higher echelons of the Communist Party. Gorbachev spent 5 years at the university, where he studied diligently, married, passed his exams, and then he was sent back to Stavropol to work for the Komsomol, the youth wing of the Communist Party. His job was a minor job for a graduate of Moscow University, but Gorbachev is a man who takes what comes in his way in stride. He buckled down to his minor assignment and was soon moving swiftly up the ladder. It turns out that he was fortunate to be sent back to Stavropol. Stavropol is not only a district which includes some of the great prairies of the South Soviet Caucasus, it's also an area which has many of the dachas of leaders of the Soviet Party, many of their vacation homes, men whom Gorbachev was able to meet and to impress. Able, willing, resolute, he moved quickly through the ranks of the Komsomol and graduated to work for the party itself when he became the first secretary for agriculture for the Stavropol area. True to his dogged determination, he enrolled in a 5-year extension course in Stavropol Agriculture Institute in order to familiarize himself with the larger problems of agriculture. Agriculture has been the stumbling block of the Soviet economy for decades, and Gorbachev was able to do some useful work, which brought him some useful attention. In 1972, he came to Moscow to fill a senior post in the Department of Agriculture. In 1974, he had become a provisional member of the Central Committee, a 300-person body which carries on the activities of governing the state. Now, the 70s were a time of rapid change in the Soviet Union. Khrushchev had fallen, Brezhnev would fall, Andropov would last but 14 months in office, Chernenko hardly that. Each new general secretary meant a reshuffling of the members of the Politburo and the officials immediately below it. Gorbachev seems to have sided largely with the Andropov group, the more reform-minded, but he remained on good terms as far as he could with everyone. Gorbachev is a man who does what is asked of him and who makes sure that his contacts are solid. He served for a while as the secretary of the Bureau of Agriculture, for a while as in the KGB. He began to be posted on trips abroad and be thought of as a senior member of the Communist Party. During Andropov's short reign, he became a trusted lieutenant who was kept close at hand and a provisional member of the Politburo. Now, the Soviet government is not a dictatorship today. It is an oligarchy. At the top are a group of men, the Politburo, who determine policies for the country. All the way down the line and through the system, the pattern is for policies to be set from above and to be carried out from below. In March of 1985, Chernenko died, and Gorbachev was one of the few natural leaders to whom the Soviet might turn, and they did. What immediately struck outsiders was his age, 54, compared to the 70s and 80s of his predecessors. He represented to the world a new generation of Soviet politicians. The new generation recognized the urgent need to revise some major parts of the Soviet system, including the way policies are made and carried out. Gorbachev is part of a generation which is younger, more flexible, more determined to live by world standards. He and many of his peers are determined to help their country out of its long economic slide, created largely by bad agricultural and industrial policies, which set heavy industry above consumer goods, and now out of a free-willing and blustering military posture. During the opening days of his administration, which is now only 2.5 years old, Mr. Gorbachev introduced two Russian words into the vocabulary of international policy: perestroika, a technical restructuring of the social order. The goal was to break up encrusted, inefficient, shoddy production units which promoted waste and corruption. Much of the problem was caused by the central ministries and committees and bureaus which run the 48,000 state enterprises from Moscow. Perestroika is a program to decentralize, to stimulate more factory, farm, and private accountability, self-financing, self-reliance, and profitability. The second term is glasnost, which means openness, freeing the media to expose bureaucratic inefficiencies, arrogance, and corruption. The Soviet media now can open its columns to tales of misuse and corruption. In a society as complex and strictly run as a Soviet, the introduction of a bit of media freedom can be quite difficult. There is the problem of limits. The Soviet Union may not be a dictatorship, but is also not yet a democracy. Freedom to criticize an inefficient and corrupt state enterprise can begin with the best of intentions and end in causing a surge of what the government considers subversion. There are over 700,000 bureaucrats responsible for setting prices and making central plans in the Soviet Union. Each of them sees his job in a way threatened. The result has been that there have been more talk than action and a great deal of confusion as the new policies are instituted and enforced. Under Gorbachev, the Soviet Union is trying to do what China has tried to do under Jiang, that is, to modernize its society, to modernize its economic policies particularly, to permit a degree of self-criticism, but to enter this freer world without surrendering the central economic concept of the Communist Party, the central control of the economy. Greater freedom for the local units and a continuation of the large-scale central control are policies which to a large degree contradict each other. The Soviet Union today is an oligarchy. Power rests with the Communist Party and goes progressively upward with its ranking bureaus and committees until one comes to the Politburo itself. The present Politburo includes men of Gorbachev's generation who understand the need for these programs and these changes. The Politburo also includes older men, and men of Gorbachev's own age, are more inclined to continue the centralization of authority in the hands of Moscow. These men argue that to give too much authority to individual factories or to individual collective farms, to criticize and to set their own agendas, is ultimately to bring the status and the role of the Communist Party into question. Gorbachev speaks forthrightly, but like the careful politician that he is moving slowly. With few exceptions, he has not yet enforced his views on the Soviet economy. The Russians, for instance, are heavy drinkers. During a recent year, the total purchase of value of the vodka, which was purchased in the Soviet Union, was about 22 billion rubles out of a state budget of 175 billion rubles. Between 1970 and 1983, the state production of vodka and wine increased by 38% and 95%, respectively. There comes a point when the economic benefits of alcohol revenues to the state are outweighed by the social and economic costs of heavy drinking, increasing crime, poor productivity, absenteeism, a larger number of problem children of alcoholic parents, reduced life expectancy, and alcohol-related health problems. 1 month after Gorbachev came into office, a press campaign began against alcoholism and drinking. The minimum age for purchasing alcohol was raised from 18 to 21. Alcohol could no longer be sold from ordinary food stores. Wine shops are not permitted to sell any alcohol before 2 p.m., nor are restaurants permitted to dispense alcohol with lunch. Stiff penalties were introduced for private stills. Being drunk in a public place became punishable by a fine, starting at 50 rubles. The consumption of alcohol dropped, but there were difficulties. Many farms which produced hops for the grain and fruit for the wine nearly went bankrupt. The state suffered a heavy loss of revenue. In this case, Gorbachev has not compromised, and the problem goes on. But in many others, he has. Another issue, a more central difficult issue, was to reorganize the management of the agricultural system, which is basic to the Soviet economy. Agricultural control has been divided among some 16 bureaus in Moscow. It would now be centered in one agricultural and industrial department. The goals of the effort have not all or even significantly been met, but there is now one address for groups to send in their complaints and their comments, and one source for commands. It is clear that uniform policies can be set in Moscow and translated directly to the country without being divided among various central offices and their various interpretations confusing the issue. Gorbachev is attempting to limit policy authority to one central agency, and at the same time, to bestow much wider authority to implement policies on local units. Again, that ultimate conundrum and potential contradiction which he faces. You'll find in the Soviet Union today very little overt opposition to perestroika. It has very little opposition in theory. Everyone recognizes past failures and the need for more local authority. But in practice, perestroika is another matter. The Soviet Union looks unbalanced. Its military-industrial complex appears to be efficient, well-equipped, and well-funded. There is a group of citizens in Moscow, as in every major city, that lives well. But the average Russian does not live well. Five-year plan after five-year plan has talked about raising the level of consumer products and the standard of living, but has largely failed to do so. And there are the old-line Communist Party members who have benefited from the old system for years. There is a fear in everyone that if plans made in and by a central authority are left to local units, that they will not be able to get the support, the tools, the equipment that they need. It's immensely difficult to change a system of central planning to one of pluralism and diversity. At the same time, to do so within the context of glasnost, open criticism of society, where political criticism is not legitimate. Spurred by the idea that the Soviet must catch up with the domestic industry and agriculture of the West, Mr. Gorbachev and his group has apparently taken a different line in foreign policy from their predecessors. The blundering and blustering, "We will bury you," of Khrushchev has given way to programs which show signs of being carefully considered to offer some possibility at least a temporary reprieve from the many costs of the arms race. On Monday this past week, the 70th anniversary meeting of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, celebrating the Russian Revolution, Mr. Gorbachev, in a long speech, said that in Washington he would sign the INF Treaty and move for a comparable breakthrough on a treaty reducing long-range nuclear weapons and banning weapons from space. He said, "The growing danger that weapons may be perfected to a point where they will become uncontrollable is urging us to waste no time. That is why we will work unremittingly at these meetings for a palpable breakthrough, for concrete results, reducing strategic offensive armaments and barring weapons from outer space. The key is to remove the nuclear threat." What Mikhail Gorbachev has done in his 2.5 years in office is to put the United States foreign policy on the defensive. His diplomacy is skillful. In the battle for the minds of Europe, he has made the Soviet Union seem a willing partner in the attempts to de-escalate the arms race. He did this by proposing a unilateral ban on nuclear testing and by proposing the elimination of chemical warfare. The first concrete results will be the signing next month of the INF Treaty. But the question remains, is this simply a ploy designed to give the Soviet Union time to rebuild its economy without losing any of its military advantage? Or is this the talk of a man who genuinely and honestly wishes to end the arms race? He has talked of getting out of Afghanistan, but Russian forces are still there. In the battle between Iran and Iraq, he has sided with the West in the matter of keeping the Persian Gulf open, but then sought to arm and to sign oil lease agreements with Iran. He has supplied the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. The Soviet military budget remains extraordinarily high. A classic case in point revolves around the refuseniks, who are a constant source of embarrassment to the Soviet Union. Gorbachev knows this. He's agreed to let some 10,000 out at the rate of about 900 a month. He has seen to it that those who come out include the most notable of the refuseniks. But he's also passed a law that seriously limits the numbers who qualify, because it states that the only ones who can leave the Soviet Union are those who have immediate family outside, husbands, wives, parents, brothers, or sisters. As soon as the 10,000 or so leave, there will be some 400,000 still locked into the trap. Gorbachev seems to be counting on the fact that without publicity, the major refuseniks enjoyed, the world will forget this human right problem. Now take Israel and the issue of the proposed international conference on peace in the Middle East. Israel has said that she will not sit down with any power which does not have diplomatic relations with her. Russia has not had an embassy in Israel for a dozen years. 3 months ago, the Soviet leader sent a small number of minor league Russian consular officials, presumably to question Israel's fitness for a reestablished embassy. No decision on the embassy has been forthcoming, but these minor Russian diplomats remain in Israel in order to make it possible for Gorbachev to say that Russia does have some political ties with Israel and therefore to stake his claim to his role, his seat, at such an international conference. Gorbachev is an apparatchnik, a member in good standing of the Communist Party who's worked his way through the ranks. He's worked with the old school. He is not completely his own man, and was shown dramatically over the last several weeks. When our foreign secretary, George Shultz, went to Moscow to firm up the date for the Washington summit, he left Moscow without a date, and with the Russian press proclaiming that Mr. Gorbachev was not prepared to come to the summit unless major progress was made on limiting, abandoning the Star Wars initiative. But several days later, Mr. Shultz's Russian counterpart, Mr. Shevardnadze, came to Washington with a letter which indicated that December 7th would be an appropriate date for the summit and that Mr. Gorbachev would be there. Now, what happened? There had been a full meeting of the Central Committee on October 21st. And during that meeting, a certain Boris Yeltsin, till then a firm ally of Gorbachev and his policies, apparently attacked Mr. Gorbachev, some have said, for having engendered a personality cult. What actually happened, we don't know. Yeltsin's speech seems to have unleashed, however, a brouhaha of comments pro and con. And it is this commotion that was blamed for the delay in acknowledging the invitation to the summit. Apparently, there is opposition to the implementation of Gorbachev's program and to its pace. Yeltsin's complaints seem to have been that it's too slow. This morning's New York Times carried an interesting article reporting complaints that it's going too fast. The Times article describes a secret report of the Komsomol, the youth wing of the Communist Party. The report emphasizes the need to bring under Komsomol control the burgeoning number of small groups taking Gorbachev and his glasnost at face value. The Komsomol is apparently afraid that these groups will flourish and undermine the activities and the authorities that have been traditionally its own. Mr. Gorbachev apparently is meeting or has met that opposition because of Samarzan. But at what cost, we do not know. Mikhail Gorbachev is neither friend nor foe, but the leader of one of the world's other superpowers. He has his agenda. In part, that agenda corresponds to certain interests of the United States. In part, it diverges from it. The emphasis on economic development, consumer goods, glasnost, may exert a compelling force on Soviet policies if they are successful. They can provide a different Soviet outlook on the world and its problems. Certainly, all of us must hope that the superpowers will be able to develop some kind of arms reduction program which will be truly meaningful. The arms race is breaking the economies of the nations of the world and faces mankind with the reality of self-destruction. What we ought not do is to assume that the Soviet Union will change dramatically or overnight. Can she relax her control over the countries of Eastern Europe? Can she turn Afghanistan to a Finland-like neighbor? Can she develop ties with the Third World different from those she has now with Angola and Ethiopia, where she is busy transforming primitive societies into ones modeled after the old Soviet way of life? Even with all these doubts, we cannot but be pleased that the leader of the Soviet Union is now speaking with a different voice. Mr. Gorbachev ended his speech last Monday with these words: "It is our duty to preserve our inimitable heritage of life on Earth, to hold reason over nuclear insanity, to create all the necessary conditions for the free, all-around development of the individual and of the whole of humanity. We are aware that there is a possibility for continuous progress and realize it is not easy to measure it. This does not frighten us. On the contrary, this inspires us, giving a lofty and humane purpose to our lives, injecting it with a profound meaning." Let this be the real Mikhail Gorbachev, but don't count on it.